Hello and welcome to the Worn and Wound podcast. My name is Blake Bettner. Today we are in studio. I am joined with Zach Weiss. Zach Weiss, hello.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, always a pleasure. And we are also joined by Zach Kazan. Zach Kazan, hello, welcome. How are you?
Hey guys, I'm doing well, thanks.
And we have a special guest today. I'm really excited about it. We've been, we've referenced him a few times, and now whenever we have any questions that we feel like we're not qualified maybe to be talking about, or think, boy, I wish Nick Manousos was here because he'd be good resources to ask. Boy, I just spoiled it right there. Our guest is Nicholas Manousos, the executive director of the Urological Society of New York, otherwise known as the HSNY. Nick, welcome to the One in One podcast. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. This is going to be a lot of fun. I'm really happy to be here, really to talk about horology, talk about watches and clocks and time, and it's what keeps us all going. So I'm happy to be discussing it with you all here today.
Yeah, definitely. And then the timing works out really well. Of course, we have all kinds of questions about watches and movements and all that kind of stuff. You've had a rather eventful last couple of months here at the HSNY. You made an announcement that coincided with the release of a launch. Before we get to any of that, though, see, I almost forgot. Let's do a wrist check. Zach Weiss, what do you have on your wrist?
Sure. So today I'm wearing a Young Hands Max Bill, one of the special editions. 2020 box set edition, I believe. So this is the 34mm automatic with black PVD case.
Yeah, beautiful.
It's a sleek little watch. Yeah.
34mm, really?
Yeah, they're like 34, 35, but all dial. So
it doesn't look like oh my gosh, that's a tiny watch. Yeah. It looks like a normal.
It's kind of like a Max Bill field watch, this one.
Yeah.
It's kind of a fun.
Yeah, I like it. I like it.
Can we see it? Does it?
If you can see, it's just a webcam. But yeah, it probably just looks like a little bit of a dot on my wrist right now. But
I can see it now. It looks good. Cool.
It's nice. They do special editions every year, and this is a box set. It came with a matching chronograph. So I split it with business partner Blake Mallon, who I'm sure many of the listeners are familiar with, and he got the chronograph. I got the three-hander, and actually, my girlfriend's been wearing it a lot more than I have. And it's a nice watch to share because it fits us both very well. So
very cool. Zach Kazan, what do you have on your wrist?
I'm wearing my vintage JLC E872 Memovox today.
Nice. The case.
It's a cool kind of like funky 70s case. I noticed that I was only one day off the correct date this morning. So,
okay, so that works.
It's not a quick set date. So I thought it would be a good day to just
this is my time.
Advance it a day. And yeah, this is it. This is what I'm going to wear. I love this watch. I don't wear it as frequently as I probably should, but I always really enjoy it.
Yeah, very cool. I'm wearing a Messina collaboration watch with Ming. This is the 1709 with the honeycomb dial. Right there, which is, and I'm wearing it on the, you said this to me last time and I forgot already. This
I forgot. So this is a Hoyt.
on the Hoyt gray stripe.
Yeah, the
right.
Gray. And I already forgot what I named the gray. I wanted to say like Tempest or something like that. Yeah. I have to come up with fun names for all these things, but then I forget them.
It works on this watch. And look at that. The hands are perfectly aligned. So there you go.
Oh, good.
Nicholas Manousos, what are you wearing on your wrist today?
I'm wearing also a watch that I don't wear enough and I should wear more. This is Glashütte original Spezimatic from the GDR era. So
very cool.
I just really like the green dial. Kind of cool.
Yeah.
Green dials were in a long time ago as well, it turns out.
Yeah, that was before the green dial boom. Yeah.
Everything is cyclical. Imagine that.
Yeah.
Very cool. When you say GDR era, what do you mean?
The German Democratic Republic. Is that? I think that's correct. Yeah, so it's pre. It was when all of the watch companies in Glashütte were consolidated. So after World War II, while that part of Germany was still under control of Russia, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Am I getting my history correct?
That's right. Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah. So they recently did Glashütte original. Recently did a kind of a modern interpretation of this watch and this really kind of cool funky dial. Mm-hmm. And I just like the original and I found it on eBay and it's on my wrist.
There you go. Very cool.
That's great.
All right, so let's get into it. You recently made an announcement alongside the release of a watch, another Messina collaboration watch, this time with Habering and Joshua Shapiro. It was the lovely, the Irwing watch, and it is a certified chronometer, certified by none other than the Horological Society of New York. So this was made alongside, this announcement was made alongside the watch that you, the HSNY, are now providing independent chronometry testing for brands. This is incredible. Tell us about this. What does this mean for the HSNY?
Well, at HSNY, we're always thinking about new ways to meet our mission, to expand our operations even further. And the chronometry testing idea, it's something that has been around for a while. We've kind of kicked it around for a while. And it started to finally make sense. We started to talk with some of our friends, our sponsor brands, to see if they would be interested in taking part. A couple of them were interested. And you know the first one already that's announced their watch. And it's really a service that we're doing for brands and for collectors, because it's an important thing. It's an important thing for a brand to be able to say confidently, yes, this is a chronometer and it was certified by a third party. And then it's also a good thing for the collector themselves to be confident that, yes, indeed, this is a chronometer. I always like to give a metaphor for this. People say, well, why do you need a third party to say it's a chronometer? Why can't you just say it's a chronometer yourself and sell the watch? Plenty of brands do that, and there's no problem with it at all. The metaphor is like saying, I'm an athlete. So if I went up to you guys and we met at a dinner party or something, and you say, oh, what do you do? And say, I'm an athlete. Like, okay, all right. Well, what do? I run the 100-meter dash. Okay. And maybe that's believable, maybe it's not. But then if you say, well, here's my gold medal from the Olympics, then it's okay. Yeah, I really believe you now. You were certified. You won a gold medal from a neutral third party. And so, yeah, it's more believable that you actually are an athlete. So the same thing kind of happens with chronometers. In throughout history, we've had observatories all around the world that provide chronometer certificates for brands. There's been chronometer competitions. There have been chronometer certification services in the U.S., but it never was such a big thing. And these days, before we just announced our certification initiative, there were no U.S.-based chronometer certification initiatives. So we thought this is something that we could do, we should do, that there's a need for it in the market, especially as the U.S. market grows and more small brands here would like certification. This is something that HSNY can do pretty easily. And it's, I also like to make the point that it's not just US based. We're open to brands all around the world. You can be anywhere in the world and we're happy to test a watch for you.
Interesting.
Quick follow up for, so this is something actually that came up when we were talking about the Messina launch originally. Like, as, so you establish yourself as a third party, do you need to meet requirements to be that third party? And if so, is there yet another party that kind of like you have to meet the standard of, or like, how does that just work?
Yeah, I think we were wondering if there was a regulating body of the regulating bodies providing this. So I guess it's just, is it the ISO or what kind of guides you in that?
So the short answer is no, there are no regulating bodies. Anyone could start certifying chronometers themselves. Worn and Wound could start certifying chronometers, and you can have your own set of tests, your own set of standards, and you could say this is a worn and wound chronometer, and that's perfectly fine. I guess an example of it is when you go to a grocery store, they have a scale, and when you put your fruit or vegetables on that scale, it says 1 pound, and you can be relatively sure that it actually is 1 pound, because there is it's either like a city or a state agency that is responsible for the accuracy checking that scale. It is indeed 1 pound. The grocery store is not ripping you off. There's no such state or city or federal certification for chronometer watches. So we're really just doing it ourselves. And we're hoping that people will trust our opinion, will trust our testing methodology that we're using. And we're kind of in a unique position to do that because we are first of all, a nonprofit organization for public education, a 501c3. And the other reason is we've been around for a very long time, coming up on 156 years. So that kind of adds a little bit of credibility that, you know, we're not gonna try and mislead anyone. We're actually doing what we're saying we're doing. Mm-hmm.
So you also mentioned the standards themselves aren't set. So like, what are your standards that will watch has to meet to be a chronometer?
So our standards are close to the ISO standards. The ISO is the International Standards Organization, and they have lots of different standards for every possible industry all around the world that you can think of. The one that is specific to watches is ISO 3159, and it's the mechanical oscillator timekeepers chronometer standard, something like that. And they specify a set of requirements that the watch has to meet, and they specify a testing protocol. Their testing protocol is over 15 days. And so our requirements, and really every chronometer standard across the world, is very close to what the ISO 3159 says. The one that matches it exactly is COSC, COSC in Switzerland. We decided to go a little bit further in certain areas that we wanted to tighten up the standards a bit. We did. And we think that those standards are still achievable. It's not like we tightened the standards so much that no one is going to be able to pass. We just thought from, when I say we, I should clarify, we have a committee. So there's a committee of people that are all involved with the program. And so we all discussed this for close to a year, mm-hmm. trying to decide on the exact numbers, the exact standards that we wanted to use.
Maybe we should jump back and say, what is the Horological Society of New York?
We always go right for the meat, you know.
Yeah, the big news there. But I realized as you were discussing this, we maybe need some clarity there.
It's a great question. What is the Horological Society of New York? The Horological Society of New York, we like to refer to it as HSNY. Is one of the oldest watchmaking associations in the world. There's actually only two that are older. One is the Worshipful Company of Clockmakers in London. They were founded in the 1600s, and they're still around today. And then in 1858 was the British Horological Institute. And we were founded in 1866. When we were founded as a guild for watchmakers in New York. It was a professional organization. There were no collectors involved. And this was when, back in the 1800s, watchmaking in the US was really starting to take off. It was a very big industry, especially here in New York. There were many watchmakers working. Interesting thing to think about here, if you were a watchmaker in New York back in the 1800s, most likely you were German. It's just the way it was. And so our organization originally had a German name. It was the Uhrmacher Verein New Yorker. Or maybe I have that backwards. New Yorker Uhrmacher Verein, which is Uhrmacher is watch or clockmaker, Verein is society. This was a professional organization. They had monthly meetings to talk about watches and clocks and horology. They had a library. They had all of these other benefits for their members, very similar to what we do today. So that organization grew and it thrived as the American industry thrived and grew. And you look at its heyday, that was back in the 50s and 60s. We had monthly meetings here in New York where there were upwards of 500 people attending. So if anyone has seen the photos or attended any of our in-person lectures, maybe you've seen a really crowded lecture, like with F.P. Jorn or Roger Smith. Those were very crowded lectures, but we had maybe 200 people. And it's kind of crazy to think about in the 50s and 60s, there were 500 people attending these lectures every month. And these were not collectors. They were all professional watchmakers working in the industry here in the U.S. And then as the quartz crisis happened, as the American industry started to fade away, close up shop, move to Switzerland, the Horological Society of New York started to have a downturn as well. We were losing membership quite rapidly. And it was just kind of inevitable what was happening with the industry. So a few years back, actually, it's more than a few years now, it's maybe 6 or 7 years ago, we decided to change things around. We decided to change from a 501c6, which is a professional organization just for people working in that, you know, as a watcher, a clockmaker, into a 501c3, which is a public educational organization. And that's what we are today. So anyone can join. The only thing you need to have is an interest in horology. And we give a lot of things back to members and to the industry at large. To members, all famously, they get the little lapel pin that everyone likes to wear. You get priority access to our meetings. Sometimes we have famous lecturers like Roger Smith, and it sells out very quickly. It's tickets are free, but they are reserved very quickly. So if you're a member, you get some priority access. We have watchmaking classes, we give scholarships to watchmakers, and we do chronometer certification. We do lots of things around education and watchmaking. That's who we are. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah, yeah, no, definitely. Yeah, it's been, I've had the pleasure of being in the space, and I think a few of us here have led panel discussions or been a part of some of the ongoings there.
Just you, I believe.
Well, Blake Malin. but I think the watchmaking classes are really cool. I've been a part of some of those, especially the traveling sessions and seeing people come in that just have passing interest, like really go through one of those classes. It's a pretty awesome experience. I love that you guys do that. And thankfully you opened up to the public interest, so people like us can be a part of it as well.
And it's also like, I mean, obviously New York is in the name, but it seems like you have a continental approach. I mean, you're doing stuff in San Francisco now. I mean, it seems like it's not a New York only type of society at this point. I mean, it seems like you're kind of maybe filling in some of the, you know, sort of maybe what was missing in some of the other organizations that were trying to, you know, maybe not as modernized as you guys have become.
That's a great point. This comes up a lot. People say, oh, I thought that you were just New York based and I can't join unless I live in New York. And that's not the case. We are very international at this point. Right before COVID started in March 2020. It was either February 2020 or March 2020. We taught, we had our traveling education classes. We went to Australia. So those were really international. And we have, we're really happy to have just restarted all of our in-person classes and our traveling classes. You see that first date in San Francisco, we've got lots of other dates planned. And it's amazing. We have members all over the world now. You don't need to be in New York. You don't need to be in the U.S., even in the U.S. And that's kind of one positive thing that's come out of COVID. We very quickly switched our in-person lectures to all virtual, to Zoom lectures. And it was just amazing, hosting these lectures and seeing people log in and tune in. And I'm thinking, it's 4 a.m. where they are. Yeah, you know, it's 7 p.m. in New York, and they're logging in from all over the world live to take part in these lectures. And so we had many, many more people attend our virtual lectures than we ever could physically fit into our event space. Mm. So we've really, kind of as a result of Zoom lectures and because of COVID, we've expanded internationally quite a bit. It often comes up, people say, why don't you just drop the of New York name? This is debated every now and then. Our board brings this up and we have a debate about it. But it's kind of a historical thing. We've been New York since 1866. We've always had New York in our name, even when we had a German name in the very, very beginning. And it's unlikely that we would ever change that. But we're based here in New York, but we travel around the world. We welcome everyone from every corner of the globe.
Yeah. I think the New York adds a little
Looks good on the pin.
Yeah, looks good on the pin.
The logo.
Yeah. What do you think, Zach Kazan? Should they drop the New York?
No, absolutely not. I think, to your point, Nicholas earlier about the history of your organization, having some credibility, and trust in the, in the watch community is really important. And the name is certainly part of that, but, there's an institutional trust with an organization like yours that happens over the course of time. And I think that's why you have this stature and in the community such that you do.
Yeah.
Thank you. I appreciate your kind words.
So Nick, well, let's talk about the watch a little bit. I wanted to ask how did that come about? Like, was the timing just like, were you guys planning on doing this before you heard about the Habering and Messina watch and you just kind of, oh, this aligns pretty well, like, let's sync it up? Or did William come to you guys and say, hey, I want you guys to do this? Or how did that relationship come about?
So we've been planning the chronometer certification project for a long time. The first discussions for it, I believe they started in 2015. So it's something that we had been throwing around because we're always thinking about, it's part of being a nonprofit. You think about how can you advance your mission? So a nonprofit, the goal is not to generate profit for shareholders. We know we're not trying to make as much money as possible. What we're trying to make is as much education as possible. I know that sounds kind of weird, but that's really our goal. So our mission is to advance the art and science of horology. And we always think, what could we do to meet that mission, go even further? So we have our lectures, we have our classes, we have our library, we have our scholarships. What else could we possibly do? Why not start certifying chronometers? It's something that we're kind of in a unique position to do. Yeah, so we started talking about it back in 2015. We thought, this is not the right time. We're not quite ready for it. It kept coming up. Probably in 2019, the discussions around it got a little bit more serious. We thought, okay, how could we do this? How could we implement it? And then really throughout COVID, throughout the pandemic, we started thinking, what are the very specific testing requirements? What would we want to see in a chronometer watch? How would we do this testing? What are, from a legal perspective, what can we say, what can we not say about a chronometer? Can we say it's a officially certified HSNY chronometer, which we can, and we do. And so the program started just by itself as a program. And that is kind of as a rule. So we're not trying to promote any certain brand. We always very specifically try and be completely neutral. So what we did is we let all of our friends, all of our sponsor brands, know that this program is going to start. We're going to begin certifying chronometers. If you would like to join, you're very welcome to join. And Messina Lab was the first to join. William is a close friend. He's also a trustee of the organization, but Messina Lab is, they're not going to be the only ones participating. There will be more being announced in due time here. So sure. We're just getting the program started. Everyone kind of, they immediately start thinking about COSC in Switzerland. Are we going to compete with them somehow? We're not going to compete with COSC. They certify millions of watches a year, a huge amount. That's, if we get to that point, that's great, but we're not trying to compete with them. We're just trying to do something a little bit different here in the US, in New York, where we think there is a space for it.
Sure.
As a brand, that maybe there's probably people who run brands that are listening. If they're interested, how do they go about applying to get a watch certified?
Just contact us. Just send an email. Mm-hmm. We're welcome to do it. I should say anyone is welcome to do it. We're happy to test a watch. I always like to say that we are happy to test a watch. We're not guaranteeing that we will certify a watch. Mm-hmm. What we're guaranteeing is that we'll test it. We have this kind of like this big legal agreement when anyone ever signs up for it. And one of the things that we're very clear about is that we make no guarantee that any watch submitted will pass the tests. It's completely up to the watch, how well it was adjusted, how well it was regulated before it came to us. We will do our tests exactly as we describe them on our website. And if it passes, you'll get one of those nice fancy certificates that you can include with your watch, and you can say that it is HSNY certified. But if not, it fails the test, you get the watch back and you could resubmit it at a later time. It's kind of like taking like the SAT exam or something. You can take, if you fail it, you can take it again. I think you maybe have to pay $100 or something. Mm-hmm. Same thing for us.
Bring back some like terrible anxiety.
Same. Yeah. Well, it's Nicholas, can you talk a little bit about the test itself? Are you testing like fully cased watches or just movements, and or what exactly goes into the physical test that you guys do?
That's a great question. That's one thing that we do differently than COSC, and this is very much on purpose. We only test fully cased watches. So I went to watchmaking school. I'm familiar with how to assemble a movement and then case it up. And I know from my own experience that when you case up a movement, there are plenty of opportunities to slightly disturb something. Mm-hmm. Right. And so what COSC does is they only test movements. So they certify movements and then they go back to the factory and they're cased up. That's okay. That's a different way of doing it. We think it is a better, safer way to test the fully cased watch. So we are the final step before it gets sold to a customer. So what we're testing is hopefully the watch in the exact state that it will be delivered to a customer. Now, we can't completely guarantee that because there's some shipping, there's some handling, maybe sure. the box is dropped, but we think we minimize that quite a bit when we test a watch that's fully cased. So that's one big difference to our testing regime.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then if you pass, you can put the triangle with the, what is it, an escape wheel inside of it on the bridge?
Yeah.
Like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Or you could put it anywhere. You could put it on the dial if you want, or you can just put the words HSNY certified chronometer on it. That logo, we spent a lot of time working on that logo. We were originally going to use the official HSNY logo. And if you've ever seen it, it's this kind of old fashioned, very complicated logo.
Very ornate.
Very ornate. That's actually, there's an even older logo from the 1800s that we have that is even more ornate, and it looks it's really crazy. But we realized that this logo was not going to translate well printed on a dial very small or engraved onto a movement very small. So we took that logo and just simplified it, minimized it as much as possible. Really, what is that logo? It's a triangle what's our traditional logo? It's a triangle with an escape wheel and an hourglass and our name around it printed very, very tiny. So we just simplified it. We just made it a triangle with an escape wheel. That's it. And it's a specific type of escape wheel. Did anyone notice that?
I only briefly saw it in the pictures. We haven't handled this watch, by the way. So yeah, tell us.
So it's most of the time you think of escape wheel, you think of a Swiss lever escapement.
Yeah.
Right? With the club tooth escape wheels. So the escape wheel in our traditional logo and in our chronometer modernized logo is a chronometer escape wheel that's used for like a detent escapement or coaxial escapements. It's a different type of escape wheel. It's the escape wheel that is more commonly thought of as a wheel that goes into a chronometer watch.
Okay.
Yeah. It doesn't mean that you can't have a Swiss lever escapement watch that is a chronometer, but it's just kind of a fun thing we did.
Yeah. All right. Well, now I know.
Yeah.
I definitely would have noticed that if I looked a little closer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Me sure.
you just brought up a good point, Nick. You are, in fact, a watchmaker, a trained watchmaker, which is what I think we originally invoked your name on the episode that we initially talked about, the Messina Habering watch, because it is a dead second watch, and we were trying to articulate maybe how this works and maybe some of the benefits to it, which we quickly realized that maybe none of us were entirely qualified to do. Nick, what's the deal with dead seconds escapement, and what's the benefit there? Why should we appreciate this?
Well, first of all, it's not an escapement. So it has the Messina Lab watch that you're talking about, and many dead seconds watches, they can, you know, most of the time use a Swiss lever escapement. They can use any escapement. The deadbeat mechanism is totally separate from the escapement. In most cases, there's a few kind of particularities that you can get into with, I think Derek Pratt did a watch that kind of had a Rollo triangle that was part of the escapement that also helped the dead seconds mechanism. But the dead seconds watch, it looks exactly like a quartz watch. So each second is each second is discreetly indicated. I think that's the correct technical way of saying it. If you look at a mechanical, most mechanical watch, you'll see that they have the very smooth sweep of the seconds hand. And that's what characterizes a mechanical watch. Even if someone maybe is not a watch collector, maybe the one thing they'll know is they'll say, oh, let me look at that watch. Are the second hands moving smoothly? If so, then it's a mechanical watch and it's more valuable. And if not, then maybe it's a quartz watch, or maybe it's a fake watch. You know, this is kind of like a classic fake watch test. So because of that, the dead seconds mechanism kind of fell out of favor because people thought, okay, well, if it has these jumping seconds hands, then it's not mechanical and it's a fake watch or it's a quartz watch. But that's not true. You know, the dead seconds mechanism is very useful from a chronometry perspective because it tells you exactly what the second is. You're not reading it halfway in between. It's not 1.5 seconds. It's exactly right now. It's 2:36 p.m. and it could be 32 seconds. Boom. That's it. Yeah. So it's great for that chronometry perspective. It actually makes testing the watch from a chronometer testing perspective easier because we don't have to try and determine tenths of a second. It's either 10 seconds or 11 seconds or 12 seconds, and that's it. So I think they're very cool. They're fun complications to have, makes the watch a little bit easier to read. Yeah. And it's just kind of a fun, quirky thing.
Yeah, I think we talked about the Geophysic and the 1 Hertz from Groeneveld and the Lange. I think we talked about a few of them, and then we were all kind of like wondering why is there like a benefit to that? Is there like a literal benefit?
We didn't think about how simple the benefit of just like you can count seconds that way.
Yeah. it's easier to count the seconds.
It's not a 1 yen, a 2 yen. Yeah.
There's another kind of historical precedence for it. You can think about grandfather clocks, tall case clocks. Most of the time, those are also deadbeat seconds, but it's for a totally different reason. It's because the frequency is so slow that that's the speed at which the second hands move. So I'm sitting here's a grandfather clock to the left of me that anyone can see when they come to HSNY, and the second hand moves once per second, and that's it. And it's because that's the frequency that the movement is running at. Mm.
Is it a complication?
That's a very debatable question. My personal opinion is no, it's not. I have the same personal opinion about a tourbillon. It's not a complication. It is complicated. It's a complicated mechanism, but it's not a complication in my opinion, because it is not displaying additional information on the dial.
That makes sense. I would argue that as well.
It's a classic definition of a complication, I think, for sure.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. It can absolutely be argued, debated either way. Mm-hmm. I've heard people debate it, and it's. I'm totally okay with disagreeing about that.
Do you know, from a watchmaking perspective, do dead stop seconds have similar issues as quartz seconds hands in the drift of the second hand?
A good question, and I don't know.
That was something I was thinking about, and I feel like
that would really drive you nuts.
They couldn't, but why? I mean, there's, you know, anyway. I would imagine
that they do. That's a good point. Yeah, you have to set that seconds hand perfectly, because if it's jumping and it's off by a tenth of a second every time, it'll drive you crazy.
Yeah.
But they're not always.
Next up, we'll have to have Hayrings on.
Maria and
We're just gonna work. We're gonna solve this dead stop question.
It's gonna be bugging us. Yeah. But it's different. It like what was it? Watch we were just talking about. It was a 1 second remontoir. So it was associated with the constant force. But they're not all like this,
right?
Was it the T0? What was it? Zekazan, you remember this?
Was it the Langa? That we were
was it the Langa with the 1 second remontoire, but they're not all associated with a remontoire, right, Nick?
No, there's lots of different ways that you can do it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yep.
Huh. I like that. I like it when it's associated with it like that. Though I don't know, it makes it more interesting to me at least. So you've been around for a while. What you have your own collecting habits and interests. What are you paying attention to these days? What kind of watches do you find yourself wearing most often?
So most of the time I wear an Apple Watch. I am really not much of a collector.
Wow. Okay.
No, there's a kind of an analogy for it. Once you know how sausage is made, maybe you don't want to eat it all the time.
Yeah, for sure.
Fair.
Well, now I feel like an idiot.
I'm just not much of a collector. It's not something that interests me. I'm really interested more in the technical side of watchmaking. I'm not interested in, this is a rare dial and it has a unique provenance or something. That's great. But to me, I'm really interested in the hairspring, the oscillator, the chronometry of the watch. And to me, that's why horology is such an amazing field. No matter what your specific interest is, there's a place for you. So you could be interested in the technical side. You could be interested in the historical side of things, watches that have been used by famous explorers through history. You can be interested in the cultural side of things, the aesthetic side of things. We're talking about dials that look really nice, right? You can think about dials that are painted or watches that have jewels on them that are really ornate. And to me, that's why horology is so wonderful. It never gets boring. To me, it's like New York City. I can still get lost in New York City. I can still go to a neighborhood I've never been to and experience it, get lost, discover something new. There's always a new exhibit going on at the Met. It never gets boring to live in New York City, right? That's why I love New York City. It's also why I love horology. It never gets boring. I'm always learning.
Certainly no judgment here.
I do collect some watches, but they're kind of different than they're not wristwatches. I really like American pocket watches. That's what I tend to focus on. They are kind of not really thought about today, but they were a big deal back in the early 20th century, and they're some of the most beautiful watches in the world, in my opinion.
Yeah,
with
sure.
Very, very special types of decoration and finishing that we don't really see in other places today. We think, this watch is nice. It has nice Geneva stripes. That's great. But if you look at some of these early 20th century American pocket watches, the decoration on these things will just blow your mind. That's what I appreciate.
Is there anything you think people should look at in that regards? Like any brands people should look up, or any books or any resources? We don't talk about that stuff that often. I think we all probably personally have some interest in it when we see them. I've never met somebody who's looked at a pocket watch, who's been into watches and hasn't gone, wow, this is gorgeous.
I think it's probably been responsible for getting a lot of people into the hobby in the first place, because their dad or their grandpa had one in a drawer. You can open up the back and you can see everything. And it's like, oh, wow. And that's the first kind of like, whoa, what's going on back there? Fun fact, I was married in a pocket watch.
You were married inside
of the pocket watch. I had a pocket watch. I was married to, I was going to say, on a watch. But yeah, it's I had one in my pocket and not a watch on, because it was my grandfather's. It was a Waltham early, 21st century pocket watch.
Very cool.
And here we all are. But yeah, what should people be paying attention to if they want to check out pocket watches?
Waltham for sure. Also Hamilton. I always like to specifically point out one model of the Hamilton, the Hamilton 992B. So today we talk about, people say, is anyone making watches in America, right? Mm-hmm. And the strictly technical definition of or answer to that is no. No one has made a watch in the U.S. since Hamilton did, when they stopped in 1969, when they last made the Hamilton 992B. And the reason for that is to be able to say that something is made in the USA, the entire thing needs to be made in the USA. And no one has done that since Hamilton did in the 1960s. So the 992B was the last American watch ever made. 100% of that watch, down to the jewels, the hairspring, the lubrication, was made in the USA. Hopefully we can get back to that at some point. It's a big hill to climb, but we're moving in a good direction.
Do you think, just we're talking about that, like the chronometry specification, like you didn't make it plus minus 0 seconds a day for 6 months at all time, you know, like you made it something that was achievable. Do you think that standard is they went too far too fast with that standard?
No, because we were meeting it with no problem at all for 100 years. And it was just, you know, no one had a problem with it. If anything, I think the reverse is true, that other countries are way too loose with their standards. To say Swiss made, and it doesn't actually need to be made in Switzerland. You could import parts, and there's a lot of technicalities with what that means. I wish that everyone was a little bit more strict with what the country of origin designations actually meant, so that you could be confident when you buy something, was it really made in that country? Or maybe they could say, you know, it was assembled here and some parts were imported, and just to be more honest about it, just to be more open about it. I think it would be good for everyone involved.
Do you see that potentially happening down the line? I mean, I know we've got kind of like the pillars of watchmakers, the George Daniels's of the world, and Philippe Dufour's and all that. Like, who are the young up and coming people that have you really excited that you're paying attention to?
I don't know about their age. I guess
maybe I shouldn't say that. The age, it doesn't matter.
up and coming. Yeah. It doesn't matter how old you are. You can still get into watchmaking. The people that I really admire the work that they're doing here in the U.S. Roland Murphy comes to mind right away. He worked at Hamilton. He's got a wealth of historical knowledge. Josh Shapiro is doing amazing guilloche work in LA, and I can't go into detail, but he's got a bright future ahead of him. Just trust me on that. Keaton Myrick is doing amazing work in the Northwest. So there are a number of up and coming watchmakers in the U.S. Well, not even up and coming. There are a number of watchmakers in the U.S. that are doing amazing things. We tend to focus most of our attention on big brands, which is okay, which is totally normal, and you know, the small watchmakers are sometimes overlooked. I think what our responsibility is to ensure that there's an entire new generation of watchmakers coming through, that are going to watchmaking school, that are graduating school, and will enter the workforce. Maybe they'll work at a brand. Maybe they will set out and make their own watches. That's the responsibility of all of us, and kind of specifically HSNY, in awarding as many scholarships as possible to encourage people to think about watchmaking as a real viable career here in the U.S.
Do you see a potential deficit in watchmakers in the U.S.? Like, it's something I think about is that, you know, watches as an enthusiast pursuit are becoming so much more, it's becoming so much more popular with a younger generation, and they're going to need to get these watches serviced at some point. And I just wonder if there are enough watchmakers to take that on.
Well, give or take, there's around 2,500 watchmakers working in the U.S. today. Mm-hmm. And this is it's an interesting question, because it's not really a what I think question. It's what the data says. So the U.S. Department of Labor Every year they publish this report that looks at every major profession in the United States, and they say how many people are working in this profession. And you can look back historically and you can see the changes in industry and how things have, you can see when the US industry was huge and there were tens of thousands of watchmakers, and you can see the quartz crisis. I'm over the past 20 years, the number of watchmakers in the US has consistently declined. Actually, it's even further back than that. Since like the 1980s, 1990s, the number has been in consistent decline. More watchmakers were retiring every year than were graduating school and entering the workforce. Mm-hmm. But I'm very happy to say that we're just starting to see signs of that decline leveling off. So what we want to do now, what our goal, what our intent on that we're going to do, is to just push even more, push even harder. This year, we awarded $70,000 in scholarships to watchmaking students. We have every intention of increasing the size and scope of that scholarship, of those scholarships, every year into the future. And the way that we can do that, the only way that we can do that, is with individual support from members and from corporate support from our sponsors that make it possible. So we'd like to get to a point in the future where we can say every watchmaking student in the country gets a scholarship. And it's not just a $5,000 scholarship, maybe it's a full ride scholarship. That's a really big goal. It's going to take a lot to get to that point. But that's, having big goals is how you make big things happen. And that's what we want to do.
That's great. It's great to hear that tide is turning and that you're starting to see the increase in the number of watchmakers.
It absolutely is.
That's wonderful.
So how can people get involved? How can they help out?
Well, the easiest way to get involved is just to join HSNY. To join us, you can go on our website. There's a big button there that says membership, and you can join. It's very reasonable, $100 per year. And for that $100, you get your lapel pin, you get priority access to our meetings, to our special events, to our classes. And at the same time, we never turn away anyone that cannot afford that $100 fee. No questions asked. If you can't afford it, here's your pin. You're absolutely still a member. And we also give free memberships out to anyone who's a veteran, anyone who's a full-time student. That's the easiest way to get involved. Even if you want to dip your toe in the water before joining as a member, come to our lectures, either virtually or in person. I'm really happy to say that just this month, we just recently started up our in-person lectures again. So we had a lecture with Mr. Emmanuel Breguet and Jeff Kingston on the history of the tourbillon. That was great. And it was our first hybrid lecture. So we had an in-person and we also broadcast it on YouTube.
Very cool. So if there's a guy out in or gal out in Kansas and they've got a few people that like watches as well and they think, well, I would love to take one of these classes, can they reach out to you and try to organize like, hey, let's get one of these out here and get some people together? Like you guys would make that trek?
Absolutely. Yeah, 100%. That's what our traveling education classes are for. We have a classroom that fits in a suitcase. Yeah. We just get on the plane, check the suitcase, and as long as we have a meeting room with a few desks and a projector, we can teach a watchmaking class. We also have our classes here in New York. In New York, it's a little bit different because we have a full-featured watchmaking classroom with all the accoutrements. It's kind of a nice, fun place to visit. And then if you can't make it to New York and there's not a traveling class coming your way, we also offer virtual classes. So we will get to you in any way you like. We love to teach everyone everything they want to know about watches and clocks.
Yeah, no, that's great. Yeah, if you're curious, type HSNY into your Google bar and I think you'll end up at the right place. I certainly hope.
Yeah.
So
you'll end up with us or either the Horticultural Society of New York.
It's a win-win either way.
Our main competition.
I sense a collab in the future.
Yes. Yes. Well, Nick, it's been a huge pleasure having you on today. Thank you so much for taking the time for us.
Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you all. This was a lot of fun. Have a great Friday and have a very happy weekend.
All right, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Nick.
Well, thanks for listening, everyone. And until next time, take care.